This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details.
Welcome in, Hysteria Nation, to a very lazy edition of Hysteria 51. That's because I got the week off. John's got the week off. The bot's got the week off. Lisa doesn't have to do jack crap. It's because we're handing the keys over to the boys from the north of us, the alien theorists theorizing. It's a very special week because they are doing an episode on our feed and we are doing one on theirs. So make sure you do two things. Number one, you listen here, you check them out. Then afterwards, you go and you subscribe to Alien Theorist Theorizing. I'm going to have links in the show notes where you can find them. All of their goodies, all that stuff. They're a blast. We've done this before with them. We've done crossovers on Patreon. And if you guys remember when we were out in LA for Alien Con, they were there as well. We did a live meet and greet with them at the Scum and Villainy Cantina. It was a fucking blast. So they're excellent, and they're like us. They have fun. They make jokes. They talk about nonsense and have a blast. This week, though, they are covering the Cisco UFO encounter. So if you're not familiar, the story goes something like this as a little teaser to get you guys ready. In the fall of 1964, an event that has been described as stranger than fiction took place in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountain range in the Tahoe National Forest. Enter 26-year-old Donald Shrum, S-H-R-U-M, Shrum, for those playing at home, who planned to enjoy a relaxing weekend bow hunting for deer. Shrum entered the forest, joking and laughing with his two hunting buddies, with zero inclination that shortly thereafter, he would be locked in the midst of a terrifying 12-hour struggle with, wait for it, alien forces. Armed with only his wits and his Hawkeye cosplay shit, his bow and arrow, Shrum poured out every ounce of his strength in an all-night battle against these would-be probers that seemed bent on overtaking him and carrying him away for a fate worse than death. It's actually a really crazy story. I think you guys are going to like it. They do an awesome job telling it. And it's kind of an interesting case because this guy was, he had classified clearance. So for a long time, the story was out there. They didn't say who he was. So that kind of came to light years later. And it's been called, here's a quote, the most spectacular report we have ever examined by Coral Lorenzen of the Aerial Phenomena Investigation Committee, or APRO. We've talked about them 1,000 times on here. And also Paul Cerny of MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, said, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that this incident is factual and authentic. I've spent considerable time, plus many visits to the main witness, and along with the testimony of the other witnesses, I can rule out any possibility of a hoax. Sit back, relax, crack open a beer, or if you're at work, if you can, crack open a beer there too, and enjoy the alien theorists theorizing this week, doing our show for us, because, it's lazy week here on H51.
In 1964, then 26-year-old Donald Shrum, with two of his close friends, traveled up into the Sierra Nevada mountain range of northeastern California. Known to history as Gold Country, the mountains not only possess rich mineral variety, but also boast an impressive abundance of plant and animal life. Shrum and his companions were set to participate in a leisurely weekend of bow hunting among the pristine forests and rugged ridges set within the Tahoe National Park. Shrum had no idea that on this trip, he would have an experience that would fill his nightmares for years. An experience that would stay locked within the files of official UFO investigators until finally brought to light in 2005. This case file joined the theorists as they talk about archery and shaft work in the Cisco UFO encounter.
Thank you. Welcome to Alien Theorist Theorizing Case File 212, the Cisco Grove UFO. I'm Braden.
I'm Zil.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Andrew in a little box.
But stuck Andrew in the studio box because BC is flooding, breaking, it's been burning. This place is fucked.
End times, baby.
End times. Yeah, if you're listening to this, we're a little late tonight. And to be honest, at any point in time, it feels like, you know, the cracks of hell might open up and just swallow us all at this point. BC, like Zil said, is under a state of emergency. Basically, all our major highways have catastrophic damage from mudslides and excessive rain. Hundreds and hundreds of people are trapped on highways. Cities are completely, multiple cities are completely flooded to the point where everyone has to evacuate. It's absolutely wild. Insane.
Dude, portions of the highway, like in the Coquihalla, have just disappeared.
Yeah.
They like no longer exist.
Just washed right out.
Gone.
It's fucked, wild because, man. I was on the roads yesterday and literally just missed catastrophe after catastrophe and just snuck by and got home. Like,
Braden was right in the head of the storm.
They were literally, there was like a mudslide, a tidal mud pool just following us home, basically, because everywhere we went, me and Miss Conspiracy, flooded immediately after we left.
Well, it's funny.
Like, we were sitting in
you were
the
heralds.
Princeton.
You were the heralds of destruction.
Two of the four horsemen.
Yeah, rolled through.
Well, it's funny. We were at Cosmic Channels and people are like, where's Brayden? I was like, well, he's probably buried.
Wait, it sells like, where's Brayden? Oh, Brayden's dead. And I'm like, well, just relax.
We should say
that. Hedging our bets.
There's a fucking chance here.
He's dead.
Yeah.
Could be.
That joke might get old real quick.
Yeah.
This is how close. At one point, there was a mudslide ahead of us. We had already got detoured from one. We'd already crossed a bridge that an hour later was completely wiped out. We were sitting in Princeton waiting for a highway update to see if we'd be able to sneak through a detour. We were eating at this pub and we got the green light being like, yo, highway is open. There's a detour. You basically got to go right now. The weather's looking bad, so go before they shut it down. We left. An hour after we left, the whole city of Princeton was flooded and that bar was underwater that we were at. An hour after
that
we were there.
That is so fucked.
That's right? So insane.
Crazy. If we would have waited 45 more minutes, we wouldn't have had to pay.
For anything ever again, because you'd be dead.
Oh, but we made it and we thought, even today, then the power was going out in West Kelowna. We're like, okay, well, maybe the podcast might just be over, but Andrew braved a dark, lightless ride over the bridge, and we put him in the studio closet, and he's here.
Boys, the power's been out at my place since, what, two? When did we, or three? When did we hop on?
3 o'clock. Yeah, 3 o'clock. Yeah.
Just gone.
Fucking disappeared.
It's going to get interesting in British Columbia because all roads out of the lower mainland of Vancouver, all major highways.
Gone.
Like I said, catastrophic damage. Like, multiple mudslide, bridges gone. And we're already in a supply shock and there is now no way for goods to get from Vancouver to anywhere else in BC or Western Canada.
No big deal. Just our main port.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so frustrating.
The only port in BC.
Having said that, I'm okay on Vancouver Island. So maybe, you know,
for now,
maybe I can send you guys some Mr. Noodles or something when you need it.
I would. Yeah.
I'll FedEx you some Mr. Noodles.
Yeah, you can only fly shit here. So anyways, we'll keep you updated as the storm continues.
And I also, before we get going, I got to give it up to Dan for finding this one. This case file we're about to talk to is fucking wild, man. It is great. Like, might be one of the best single accounts of a UFO encounter.
Wow, when you say best, you mean like most entertaining.
Detailed, yes. One-on-one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Encounter.
The best singular account of a UFO encounter. It is, yeah, I will agree. I'm 100% agreeing with Brayden. This is a very, very, or an absolute gem of a case file that I found this, scouring around for case files as I normally do. So, like we said before, this one's usually referred to as the Cisco Grove UFO encounter. And most of the information comes directly from the source. And it was a lot of the stuff that we're going to be talking about comes from the book, if you want to pick it up, The Aliens in the Forest, The Cisco UFO Encounter by Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte. And it was published in 2011. This actual story didn't really gain a lot of traction until the early 2000s, even though that the events that are described in the book took place in 1964. And the primary person that had the encounter, Donald Shrum, when he came out and talked about this and wanted to put the story down into a book, he was 73 at the time. So 2011.
And honestly, like, I think his name should be, when you think UFO encounter and abduction or anything like that, you should be thinking Donnie Shrum before you think of Travis Walton.
100%.
You know, this guy should be up there with Betty and Barney Hill.
Well, didn't they make a movie about this guy?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm pretty positive fucking this is the basis for Predator.
Yeah. Is it not? Or Rambo 2. Yeah. I mean,
yes.
You're not far off.
It's not far off.
So like I said, the whole series of events starts in 1964, and it takes place in the rugged foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains in the Tahoe National Forest of northeastern California. Now,
that Bigfoot country,
Northeast. Yeah.
Oh, dude, yeah, oh yeah, it's Bigfoot country for sure.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Also, yeah, also known for, that's where you get the Sierra sounds, I believe. Like that took place in the Sierra Nevadas as well. So Friday, September 4th, Donald Shrum and two of his friends took a trip out to a hunting trip out into these mountains. So they made camp about 3 miles south of Route 40 near one of three small lakes that were in the area. And I believe rifle hunting season hadn't opened up and they were going to go hunting. So they had taken their bows with them.
It's bow season. So usually like 2 weeks before something, they have a special time that's just for bow hunters and junior hunters to go out. So these guys were definitely taking advantage of the open bow season. Which is a hard hunt, man.
Well, but these guys were seasoned vets, though, man. Like, you talk about the equipment they brought with them. They were bringing harnesses so they could sleep in the fucking trees if they had to.
Not fucking around.
No, man. Like, these guys are, like, what are we talking about? This is some Predator shit.
Well, I think, too, it's not necessarily just to sleep in the trees. I heard lots of people talk about that. And, oh, yeah, belts to sleep in the trees, that and that. But it's also like, dude, bow hunting is super hard because you can't, it's like, you know, you got to basically surprise the deer, right? You have to get a jump on them, be close enough that the bow is effective. So that's an old style method of like a tree blind too. You can climb up and you have that. And so you can prop yourself up almost in a tree blind. So when you're sitting up there for a long period of time, what you're hoping is that a deer comes underneath you. And you get a nice shot
at the top of the skull
from above it.
How far away do you think you have to be to make it about as effective as a rifle, right? Like you could probably be like fucking 10 feet away from that thing and it's still going to work like a gun.
Oh, yeah, you could be. No. I'm not sure about their bows that they brought, but like one of those new like modern compound hunting bows.
Yeah. Well, this is the 60s. I don't think they had compound bows back then.
There was the specific bows that they're using, I believe, are 60 pound recurve bows.
Yeah.
Fucking Robin Hood shit.
It's a good bow. But like I said, like nowadays, you wouldn't use those belts because there's like tree designs where you can basically like prop up a chair so you can sit comfortably in the tree. But I imagine back in the 60s, like that's what you would do. So I don't, when I was reading a lot about this, like, oh, they brought belts to sleep in trees. I'm like, no, that sounds like people who don't know what the fuck, never gone for a hunt, especially a bow hunt. Like, I would imagine that those belts were primarily used. So when you climb a tree, you would sit there, like, prepped for a bow hunt, not to sleep in a tree. It was more of a, like, you were using it as a tree blind or a tree stand. we have better stuff now.
I don't know, man. I'm hearing all this like wise hunting fucking information from a guy that just went out for a week and didn't get shit.
Yeah, this is true. Right?
That's all I'm hearing.
This is true. Fair. And he had a rifle. So,
yeah.
So now they were getting ready for their evening hunt. And I don't think necessarily that they were planning on sleeping overnight or anybody was planning to spend the night in a tree at this point. They were all kind of going out. They were trying to stay within earshot of each other, within visual range of each other. And Donald said that he went down one ridge and another friend went down to the canyon bottom while the other went down the other ridge. And they didn't have walkie-talkies with them at the time. So they didn't really have any other means of communication except, you know, pretty much like whistling and trying to keep each other in sight.
But they had a plan in case of, you know, in case like these guys were seen, because they had a safety plan in place of if someone got lost, there would be no panicking until morning because they set this base camp up. What their plan was if you get lost or separated, stay put for the night, make your way back in the morning. Right. And if you're not back by morning, then the other guys are going to start to organize some sort of search for you. So they had plans in place for, you know,
climb a tree, have a snooze.
So if you got 12 hours, if you fuck yourself up, to just wait it out.
So Shrum said that he had gone on the top of the ridge and with the rest of his fellow companions down below, they told him to go around the ridge, but they didn't actually realize that how far that ridge went out and how actual far that he would have to travel to get around it. So he got a little bit lost going around that area.
And that happens so quick while you're hunting, man. I don't know how many times I've looked through a tree line and been like, oh, there's a clearing just up the hill. I just got to make the top of this hill. Then I can see it opens up and you get to the top of like the hill you were looking at. And then you look and you're like, all right, just a little further. And I think it opens up. And then you go and you're like, it still hasn't opened up. You're like, God damn it. I'm just getting fooled here by where you are on the hills and stuff. And next thing you know, like I've been turned around in the woods. You can get turned around so fucking quick. So unbelievably quick.
That's why you got to bring breadcrumbs, man. Haven't you read that book?
Yeah.
Drop yeah, and they get eaten by crows. Like, that's the whole thing. That's like, so he gets turned around. He's a little bit lost. He's not exactly sure how he's going to get back. So, you know, the best plan of action at that point is pretty much to stay put. As any, you know, most survivalists will tell you, like, if you get lost, kind of stay where you are in the general area. And, so the sun started going down. So Shrum pretty much recognized that he was going to have to spend the night outside. Now, at the time, before they had gone hunting, you know, they had been listening to the radio and reports about, you know, what was going on in the area. They'd picked up, reports of bears in the area. And so Shrum decided that he was going to go ahead and climb a tree and in order to find a safe place to spend the night, you know, so you don't get eaten by a fucking bear while you're sleeping.
It's funny because when I looked at this case, I read this part, I was like trying to think in my head while I was like, well, I don't think I'd ever climb a tree. I'd probably just lay on the ground.
And then
I thought about it. I'd like put myself in the shoes of like, it's getting dark and like just coming back from a hunt where a couple of times it's getting dark, you start to get spooked. I'm like, you know what? Yeah. 100%. I'm climbing a tree because, you know, fuck, dude, they don't have grizzly bears in the Sierra Nevada, but they have black bears. I'm sure they have wolves. And I'm like, there's predators, man. There's predators that will sniff you out, right? They'll sniff you out and they'll come and take a peek.
And Bigfoots.
And if they think you're vulnerable, they'll give it a go. Not to mention cougars and stuff. I was like, then I was like, you know what? I'm get your ass up the tree.
Yeah, big time.
100%.
Shrum estimated that he was probably about 3/4 to a mile away from the camp, which doesn't sound that far, but out in the fucking woods and the mountains, I'm sure it's like, holy shit. Like, I imagine you'd just be fucking totally turned around at that point. So as he's sitting up in this tree, you get to around 9 p.m. where he reported that he observed a strange kind of light in the sky that caught his attention. And it was just flying just below the mountaintops to the north of his position. And this light was moving, seemed to be moving from east to west, but didn't seem to follow any straight type of course. So seemed to be kind of going up and down. It didn't stay at it. Like he, when he was observing it, he said it wasn't really staying in like a stationary or like a fixed altitude. It seemed to be kind of oscillating up and down as it was going along its way. So Shrum originally, you know, when he commented about it later, he originally thought that his friends had gotten a hold of, you know, a Forest Service, and they had managed to, you know, get a helicopter out there, and they were coming to look for him.
Oh, he thought he thought it was a chopper.
Right. He thought it was a chopper.
That would have been pretty amazing. He's only gone for the one night. They've already called search and rescue. They're already bringing a chopper.
He's probably sitting in that tree being like, fuck, boy, stick to the plan. It's all good. I'm having a snooze in the tree.
This struck him as odd. He was like, well, goddamn, like we had a plan, right? So he, again, these guys are seasoned vets. So he climbs down and he makes, you know, the standard SOS, like three signal fires. I'm guessing, like, I don't know if he already had them prepped.
Like or what, but
he lights three signal fires, boom, right? Because he's like,
right.
Okay,
as soon as he saw that, he started gathering material together. He said he climbed out of the tree, dropped down, and started gathering material and then lit the fires.
Because he's thinking that these guys have done just that. And he's like, okay, well, I better do my part then and at least make myself, like, you know, known.
So, you know, he says, I stood between the two fires. I built on rocks and he waved his arms back and forth, yelling and screaming, trying to make himself as visible as possible to this light. And then finally, the light started coming towards his position.
When Shrum knew he fucked up.
Well, the first thing that he noticed was that this object that was coming towards him, this dark object that made no sound. There was zero sound coming from it. So, you know, once you hear it, once you don't hear that.
Not a chopper.
You know, that kind of, not a chopper.
Yes, not a chopper.
What he ended up remembering seeing this thing of what he observed, this object, was that on the forward end of it, probably the most prominent feature was this, a small point of light, which he started to think of as a headlight, kind of pointing down and like moving, like a searchlight moving across the ground. But another thing that he said was that the hull of this ship, the outside surface of this ship, seemed to him to absorb light, like blacker than black, that kind of thing.
Fucking Solarius.
Darker than dark.
So Shrum does pretty much the only option that he really has to do. I mean, it kept him safe in the beginning there. He says that I just threw up my bow up in the tree. I got up there. And he had camouflage clothing on at the time, head to toe, and with the hat and everything. And so he just got back up into the tree and froze, hoping that this object would not, you know, single him out or focus
single
on
him out or the three fucking fires he just lit.
They can't see you if you don't move. Everyone
Their
knows
vision
this.
Is based on movement.
Everyone knows this.
Well, I watched Jurassic Park.
T-Rexes and UFOs. Yeah, everybody knows that. So the object, he said, made a large sweeping half circle maneuver to the east past him. He's probably relieved at the time. And then it moved over to a nearby canyon on the south side of the ridge. Now, he remembers kind of giving a good estimate of the length of the craft. He said probably about 150 feet.
I thought he said 99.9.
No, no base nine.
No base nine on this one.
No base nine on this one. Though it could have been 145.99.
So what you're saying is it could have been a base nine.
He just gave an estimate of 150. So, I mean, it could have been somewhere in that area.
And it's so funny, like a couple of the readings, that I found and stuff, people talking about it, a lot, they would get hung up on this like equivalent to a 14 story building. And like, I clearly understood this to mean that like he was just giving it that like if you took this object that was flying and straightened it up, it was like a 14 story building.
Right.
But a lot of people were like, that's how it must have been flying straight up and down. I was like, no, that's not what he said. I was like, it's so easy that he's trying to give you like a, you know, to give you an estimate of like
a reference.
And And then people like, so this thing was just traveling through the vertical, a 14 story building travel. Like, no, that wasn't
casual high rise building.
However, you know what? If it's an anti-gravitic craft, like, why not?
Right? It can do whatever it wants.
Who's to say which, yeah, do whatever the fucking angled. Like, you know, it doesn't matter, I guess.
Now, Shrum, one of Shrum's hunting buddies that was on that trip with them, Vincent Alvarez, even though he was actually, you know, during the night, they weren't sure where Donald had been. You know, they were still kind of sticking to their plan as far as they were concerned.
Oh, buddy, and they were three beers deep. They probably had a cast iron over the fire cooking up some bacon.
Fucking Donnie. Yeah. But Alvarez seems to corroborate at least some of Shrum's story, because he also said that he saw this UFO. Like, he saw something. He saw a light in that area where Shrum had claimed to be.
So he got, so at least have one other witness to the UFO.
Right. So this bright object that had been floating around that area. Now, Donald Shrum says that he sat there in his tree, motionless in his camo. And he said for what probably could have been 4 to 5 minutes. And then something came out of one of the panels that was lining the side of the craft. Now, he said it was the second panel. I think he said he identified like three separate panels that seemed to be comprised of some sort of material that he compared it to what they kind of seemed like was like if you took aluminum and you shined a light on it and you kind of like shake it back and forth, that's what they seemed to do.
I know, yeah, so I know that
like
sound.
Reflected light or something like that was going on in there. But out of the second panel, the middle panel, he saw a type of flash. And then something went straight down the hill. A short time later, he would see what he started, they refer to in the story and what he seemed to kind of think of as some type of scout ship, a second craft, a smaller craft that exited out of the larger one.
He saw some sort of mothership at first, this thing. And then,
well, yeah, you could refer to it as the, you know, for the purpose of the story, you could refer to it as a mothership. And then this second object,
the baby ship.
Given the size, that makes a lot of sense.
Right. So he's
right. Cause that looks like that fucking, that's like the size of the one from Independence Day. That's a big motherfucking ship.
15 stories. Yeah.
That's a big fucking ship, dude.
So it stops, seems to hover there. The panel seems to warp or something. And a ship comes down the hill.
Right, something comes out of that panel. Now, he says that he saw like the top of like some type of like silver dome, what he identified later, like over the tops of the trees. And this silver dome scout ship had a blinking light on it, apparently, and then became stationary on the side of a nearby hill, which he said was probably about a half a mile from where he was seated in that tree.
So we got a saucer, like a saucer shape.
Mm-hmm. Very, like a very probably archetypal, you know, your typical
dome on top and bottom
you would see. And then a few minutes later, from the direction of this smaller craft, he saw these short, stocky beans emerge from the kind of tree line from outside the forest that it was. And then he would describe these creatures as humanoid looking.
Oh shit. And they
were approaching him from the northwest, kind of making their way. He kind of said they were kind of making their way through the brush and through the trees. I mean, they were interacting with their surroundings. So they were moving through and pushing brush aside. And he seemed to think that they were kind of looking for something. Kind of seemed to be that they were interested in the foliage or whatever it was around them, but they seemed to be kind of moving around with some type of purpose.
Did we know anything about the weather that night? Like, was it a pretty clear night?
I believe it was a pretty clear night.
Because that would make sense then because this is one part of the story where I like to picture these things in my head. I like to picture, you know, sitting up there and you're looking, and the only way where I think you could like get your eyes to adjust that to that, be able to see, is if it's like a really starry night, or maybe you've got, you know, a big moon in the sky as well. that you could see, you know, shapes and stuff in the distance, you know. But if it was,
it was a pretty bright moon. Like, I'm pretty sure, like, it was either like a full or almost full moon. Like, I'm pretty sure
it was well illuminating.
I mean, you could look it up on the lunar calendar, like September 4th.
Yeah,
1964.
Zell's on it. Zell's on it. He's gonna beat you.
Actual phase of the moon was.
You can see it. He's doing it.
What we got.
He's in the zone.
As September 3rd was a waning crescent. September 4th.
Oh, that would definitely not be a
full moon. Was a waning crescent on September 4th, 1964.
Moon's a waning crescent, so not that bright, but there's still moonlight.
There's still moonlight now, and with like stars and stuff, if you're up there, like you can see, you can get some good night vision going. And to be honest, we don't even know how many carrots this guy's eaten.
Yeah, true. What's his rods and cones like?
Yeah,
I mean, you know what though? Like tonight, for example, we get a fucking awesome moon tonight. I can't see fuck all at my house. It's pitch black,
dark as
like,
hell.
Yeah, like fucking Zalarius is hanging out by my place. I guarantee it.
Sucking all energy around.
Like you can't see fuck all. You can't see, I can't even see my feet in front of me here. Like,
so we have a pretty good description of what these creatures look like. And from Donald's recollection of what they look like, I think we have a picture too of like his original sketch and, or the kind of.
Yeah, they're wearing some sweet, like fucking 80s Miami Vice suits with puffy shoulders.
Yeah, I mean, here we
a little go. Bit like that.
Yeah,
kind of. Maybe if they were like rad suits.
We just got the Google search image up here, so we'll see what comes up. But
so he described these humanoids as standing approximately probably about 5 feet tall, and they were dressed in these full tight fitting light colored uniforms, like tight, not super tight,
like silver suits.
You couldn't make out like their abs or anything. I mean.
So not tight enough.
Were they tight fitting silver suits? Because we've heard of these before in other encounters.
Tons.
And he said that the joints, like at the elbows and like the knees, there appeared to be the kind of like, he describes them as bellows, but like that corrugated kind of look, and like where you would put the joints in like a diving suit or something. Like that's where
slimmer like space suit.
Right. But the thing is like, they seem to be human in form, but they're just like really short. Like they were very short proportioned. Like
yeah, look, 5 feet isn't that short, Dan. Well, but relax. They were short. 5 foot, that's not that small. All right?
No.
Depends who you ask.
Come on now.
Now, like in the pictures, you'll think it's like cut, like some type of visor or something seems to be up over their face. But he described that they were covered by, it was just a hood of some type. And then, or a helmet.
Looking like Cobra Commander.
You could see the face. But the face was dark and like featureless. And he does this, he goes down in the story to kind of describe like what the nose looked like. They had some type of like just like a flat nose.
That picture kind of makes it look like Talon, like Court of the Night Owls.
And funny you mentioned that, because the thing that probably impacted him the most, he'd say later, was the eyes. Like they had these huge, what he could see like in these hoods, he could see these huge dark eyes that he kind of compared them to goggles, but they didn't seem to be goggles. Like they were darker than the rest of the face, like the rest of the featureless face. They had these just huge dark orbs for eyes.
It's a terrifying.
Absolutely.
Like you see these things coming out of the woods, dude, I
no thanks.
Would have shit myself up in that tree.
So he had one actually approach him at first. And then he said like moments after that one appeared, like a second one came. So you have these two creatures stopping about 100 feet northwest of where Shrum is sitting in this tree, motionless in his camo. And they seem to be studying or gathering samples from what he identified as a type of manzanita bush. That's just a type of plant.
Shrub, yeah.
That's a type of shrub. Now, I didn't know this before I read in the book and you know, learned this, but there are certain species of manzanita bushes that are they're native to the United States. And there are actually 106 species of manzanita, and almost 95 of them are found in the mountainous areas of California. And there are actually some species that are among the rarest plants in the world. Like, they are actually classified, even today, they are still classified as like endangered species. And there's only small areas in the Sierra of Nevada where they grow.
They're pretty cool looking shrubs.
That's an interesting tidbit.
It's a cool name too.
You know,
manzanita. Yeah.
Possible reasoning of these things coming down in this area.
Oh, like they're aware that these plants are only found in this one region.
That's why they're there.
Yeah.
Well, they seem interested in one of the bushes that seems to be a manzanita.
Has anyone tried smoking them?
That was my exact next question.
I'm not sure.
Has anyone smoked manzanita?
Pod trip to Northern California.
I don't think you want to smoke it.
Smoked manzanita.
That's what the government wants you to think.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But so while they're in mid study of exploring and seem to be, you know, assessing the area and they're, you know, assessing the area for foliage or whatever they're doing, one of the humanoids stopped and then moved directly to the base of Shrum's tree.
Oh, he spotted Shrum. He didn't stand still enough.
And then as the first one is standing there, shortly after, the second one joined it. And then they both stared up directly at where Shrum was seated in the tree.
That's a terrifying, just to picture that in your mind. You're stuck up in this tree. These two random humanoid looking alien figures.
One comes directly to your tree.
Looks up. His buddy comes over.
Then the second one comes.
He looks up.
Dude, is there ever a moment to go more fucking Legolas on both these weirdos? Like, come on. Well,
it's funny because this is where Shrum states that at this point, he knew they were there for him. I'm like, that really? And that the second one coming, the first one coming, you're like, maybe he doesn't see me as he's just looking up in the blackness right at me. But now that his buddies come to now, I'm sure they're here for
now. We got ourselves a situation.
Now I got an issue.
So, and an interesting bit after this is these two creatures are staring directly at Shrum, and this is where he gets the really good impression of what their eyes look like and what they like.
What they're illuminated really by disturbing, fire as well.
Yeah, really disturbing eyes. And you know, back to Andrew's mention of the Court of Owls, Shrum said that he heard these creatures making strange hooting or cooing noises, which he compared to the sound of what an owl would make.
Dude, I'm telling you, we got it all wrong. The Mothman was never a Mothman. He was an owl man, and these are his owl people in their spacesuits.
You did say that on the case file. More like owl man.
And even more interesting, he said that there seemed to be a similar sound emanating from the hovering mothership. Every time, and he kind of seemed to note it, like when he focused in on this, he kind of concentrated on this interaction that seemed to be going on. Yeah, he said it seemed to be that every time the noise would come from the ship, those creatures would do something else. Like they would change their course of action of whatever they were doing. So he said that he kind of connected these sounds and the creature's actions that it might have been some type of a communication between the
bosses
two.
Bosses up there being like, yo, you guys, but then get also those manzanitas, dude.
We need those manzanitas,
come on,
bro.
Let's go.
It's interesting that they like speak in, it's almost like, because I'm not going to say they speak in owl, but I'm like, maybe they're using something where it basically their speech is now camouflaging, talking to the open, and you know, like we thinking it's, you know, just a couple owls hooting, right? Maybe that's not their native tongue, but it's something to do with like their way of camouflaging around like, I'm going to be listening really carefully next time I hear a Babylon Brook.
It's fucking interesting too, because like I'm trying to rack my brain right now, but like 90% of these cases we talk about, it's all ESPN. Owls. No, it's all ESPN. Yeah, they're talking to each other in each other's brains.
Right.
They're never making noises.
Not usually audible, no.
No, right?
Besides these two that he has staring up at him from the thing, he said that he heard other sounds from around the area. So it seemed to be that there were more creatures or more beings kind of moving around and on the outside, like right outside of his vision, maybe out in the dark. But he kind of guessed that there could probably be somewhere between 5 and 6 of the other ones. Like he caught, and he seemed to catch glimpses of more of them, kind of going over rocks and some of the other and through the brush, you know, kind of thrashing around.
Oh, Dan, just before we get to the next creature we're about to talk about, we got to take a quick beer break because...
Sounds good.
It gets wild.
It's going to get crazy.
Woo. Hang on to your butts.
Be right back.
Hola, David. Me amo Brent.
Bonjour, Brent. Je m'appelle David.
You didn't do Spanish. I thought if we were going to do this together, we'd do the same language.
Oh, sorry.
that's on brand for us.
I just thought romance languages was the key.
Everything I say is romantic, and that is thanks to Rosetta Stone. You guys, we've been touting these things forever. We love Rosetta Stone, and we actually are users. David, you've really been using it even for longer than I. What's your experience been like?
Oh, it's been great. The thing is, you really get to learn how to speak and think in that language with it, so... It's very high on pronunciation, too, so you can, you know, learn how to speak.
And you know our show is all about proper pronunciation.
In that pronunciation, yeah, that's right. But they design it for long-term retention, you know. If you don't get the pronunciation right, you say it until you do, and then, you know, that just seeps into your head.
Well, and that's why, you know, this has been trusted by experts for 30 years, and there's over 25 different languages that you can learn, and people, millions and millions of users use it because, like you said, it does seep in and you're using it with, you know, you get speech recognition and mm-hmm. it hears you. You get to use like the built-in true accent features that gives you this pronunciation, which is super convenient, and you can do it at your own time. And I don't know if you know this, but I'm all about value, and you get a one-time purchase, 25 languages. If I learned all 25 languages, I'd be so confused. Or really cool. I have to go in and out.
But you'd be real marketable.
But literally, though, this is something that we use, and both of us have given the seal of approval because we wanted to do this long term, and it's something that it works, you know. And we don't do long term stuff like this. And this is the one that we've chosen, and we love it. So, all you guys got to do, don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now, as we've told you 1,000 times, and it's always now. Right now, get now. Started. For a very limited time, Hysteria 51 listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off.
How much?
50%. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your unnatural life.
Wow.
Redeem, redeem, redeem. How do they do it?
Rachete, you're 50% off. Rachete. Redeem it. 50% off. RosettaStone.com/today. Do it today.
We're back
for round two of the epic.
Bring in the next humanoid.
Shit's gonna get fucking weird, boys.
Feature.
This is when stuff gets super awesome.
So now Donald Trump is talking about how he has noticed like more than one of these 5 foot, like these smaller figures, like he can identify them from their whitish silver things. And he's kind of seen them kind of moving behind the brush and through the trees on some of the like right outside of like where he's a little bit farther than the other two that have actually seemed to notice him. Then he hears a crashing, thrashing around sound, like seeming to come directly from the forest in his direction. And when he looks over to the source of the sound, he sees these two huge eyes coming toward him. And he describes these things looking as like two flashlights hooked together. So it's like two beams of light, like fucking Iron Giant, like, you know, coming out. And he described, but you know, not Iron Giant, like nice, you know, white, warm white color. It is a reddish orange color that he described as the color of fire. And these things illuminated the face and the jaw of a robot like creature that was rapidly approaching where Shrum was perched in his tree.
Was it screaming, "Ignore me!
Ignore me!"
Venture Brothers fucking throwback.
There. Wasn't the Observer. Hmm. Wasn't the Observer. Now,
at this point, Now Shrum stated at this point, he wasn't 100% sure before, but now he knew they were after him.
That this is the
like
final.
Before the two, he was like, you know, maybe 90%. Now a robot's coming out of the woodworks. He's like, okay, no, yeah, they're here for me.
Right. But this one, so you've got this, what he describes as, you know, a typical robot. And from his illustrations later and ones that were made, like kind of enhanced from his versions, it looks very much like, but like 1960s Iron Man.
Wait, listen, like, are we positive fucking Schirmer over here? David Schirmer. Is he, Shrimp. Are we sure he's not a fucking mutant? Are these just sentinels coming to get him? Like, do we know this?
Brought in the We're Sentinel sure. program?
Yeah.
I mean, he survived, there in the Sierra Nevada around that September, like the temperature could probably drop to around freezing. And as we'll get to in a point, he survived an entire night without any real like cold gear.
This guy's badass.
Perched up in that tree. So maybe.
Okay.
Well, it's September. I mean, can't get that
cold. It's not that cold.
But like up in the mountains and stuff, like it's still cold. True. Like they still get Absolutely. Pretty close to like.
Depends on elevation, I guess. Nah. How high up there.
So this robo-mechanical monstrosity approaches Shrum's tree and takes up a position right down alongside the rock where the embers of his fire had been. And he said it performed a type of action that he kind of considered unusual, and he marked like kind of to remember that it reached out one of its arms and it swept off the remains of the signal fire that he had built there.
That's buddy, fucking
if that's not some sort of tell of like there's no one's coming to help you, I don't know what is. Like that's terrifying.
Well, not only that, like, you're making it pitch black.
Darker
you're
than
taking
dark.
Out the light, man. Like you're not gonna be able to see anything.
The last sliver of light is snuffed out as this fucking robot comes waltzing over to your tree.
That's fucking terrifying.
Now Shrum remembers that it performed some kind of motion with its hand, which suddenly caused or seemed to cause a cloud of whitish vapor to spray out of its mouth. So just like you can imagine that kind of coming out, and yeah, it formed a cloud or it seemed
like
to
a
like
fog machine almost, mm-hmm, right?
Yep, yeah, seemed to congeal into some type of cloud, form into a cloud, and it just went straight up Shrum's tree. It started to rise up into the air, up to where Shrum was sitting.
Trying to poison him.
And the creature itself and this cloud of vapor was upwind of him, so it just came up and acted like he compared it to nitrogen, and just like a gas, like just lighter than air gas coming up there. And he didn't smell anything. He couldn't smell anything, so he wasn't, you know, you couldn't really identify what type of gas it was, but there was no smell. And then, but he felt like the air was like being pulled out of his lungs. He was having trouble
suffocating,
breathing, gasping for air, and then blacking out.
So something that interrupts the oxygen exchange in his lungs, and he gets hypoxic and fucking passes out.
Passes out. So he's up in the tree. Fuck. He passes out. Does he fall or what's happening?
No, he's not strapped in yet.
He's not strapped in yet. How does he not fall out then?
He slumps over the branch and he kind of falls into his bow that's propped him up.
Right. So he kind of has like the foresight to kind of put his bow down and then like he said that he fell across his bow and that kept him from completely just tumbling out.
So I need a diagram here, boys.
I imagine he's straddling
a branch with his back against the tree.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And then he puts the bow across and as he falls. So he's almost like tabletopped.
Yeah. But when the fucking branch, like you're going to lean to a side, you're not going to be perfectly across. How big is a branch? You're just going to fucking topple over.
That depends maybe how
he's going to teeter totter that shit and fucking fly right
he's
off.
He's got spectacular balance even when he passes out.
I don't know, boys.
I just think if it's a thick branch, right? Like he might just topple onto it.
Yeah, if it's a big ass branch.
Or as we said, like he falls into his bow. So his bow is maybe there's two other branches beside his bow is wedged there. He falls. There and it's kind of like a shelf. He kind of like falls on a shelf.
That makes sense. There we go. Okay. Zell solved it.
Let's go with that.
Yeah. Oh, I can buy that.
So Shrum blacks out from this vapor, which seems to send him into like a, you know, knock him out for a second. And then he says he remembers waking up when it probably estimated to be around.
Then when he wakes up, he stated, he wasn't 100% sure before, but now he knew they were after him.
He was so he's
we've wait. Said that three times now. What's no,
he
happening?
Was,
here?
He was 90% when he's seen the two humanoids with maybe yeah, he's
like,
other
he's
ones.
Like, so then he moves up to like 92, he's then like, 95, then no, he's 100, like,
the robot comes.
He's 97 with the robot. The robot yeah. poisons him. Tries to poison him out of the tree. Now he's like, okay, he's like, I think we okay. got it now.
Well, but listen, like you can't just like, you can't aim the poison directly at him. This is vapor. So maybe they're trying to do something else on the fucking tree.
Well, that's fair.
Right? So maybe now right you can get up to like a 98.
He's at 98. He's like, you know what? If I was a betting man, I would bet that these things are after me.
He's
this camo is not working.
He's yeah. thinking at this point, oh, this robot's just trying to like herbicide this tree. He's still, yeah. you know, it's not yeah. not necessarily
gonna fucking pine
me.
Beetles, man. They're coming back from the past. Yeah. Take care of the fucking pine beetles.
Now, so he estimates about this time, like when he wakes up and he says he's got like, he's dry heaving. He said he felt like from the effects of the white vapor wearing off, he said that he was kind of like heaving as he woke up and kind of estimated to the time to be around 11 p.m., probably midnight at this point. Now, this is where stuff gets real fun as that, you know, Shrum is now, as Braden said, that he is 96%.
98. Sure. No, we moved up to 98.
Or 96 yeah. to 98% sure that these creatures are here to get
for him
or focused yeah. on him, are here for him. And the only thing that Shrum has at his disposal that he can think of right off the bat is his 60-pound recurve bow with the 26-inch pole.
Fucking right.
Yeah, buddy.
So Shrum channels his inner Hawkeye, knocks up his first arrow, and takes aim at the robot that is standing directly below him.
Now, he had reasoning for aiming at the robot. One, because it
fucking poisoned him.
and he obviously wanted revenge for that. And two, he felt that this thing, whatever it was in fact robotic, and that he didn't feel comfortable shooting at humanoid beings.
Right.
No, yeah. And he's like, listen, there's a 98% chance this thing's after me. I gotta take it out.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
I'm not risking the 2% chance that it's friendly.
He still doesn't think it's going to kill him.
Yeah.
So he fires his first arrow at this robot creature, and he says it's probably within about 12 feet away, and strikes the robot straight square in the chest.
Maximum impact at that range, 12 feet.
And Shrum recalls seeing a very bright flash of light, like a big arc flash, like an arc welder.
So like sparks. Just,
I believe Shrum was a welder by trade. He had been worked on like a rocket factory, is where he originally had been doing. And so he was very familiar with this kind of stuff, but he compared it to an arc welding flash. And after being struck with this arrow, the creature kind of moved back about 10 or 20 feet.
Staggered him.
But the arrow, from what Shrum could tell, hadn't inflicted any type of real noticeable damage on the creature's body.
I tell you, it sent the other two humanoid creatures into the woods, though. They're like, oh, fuck, we're out of here.
Yeah, those ones that had been originally standing like another additional 10 feet, probably about 10 feet away from where the robot was, they fucking booked it.
He's like, he's shooting trees at us.
Yeah, there's probably one of those dudes in that robot controlling it. Fucking
dude, when I read the flash, like it hit him and there was a flash, I was like, this robot's equipped to some type of force field.
I thought it was like a Zord, you know, in the Power Rangers when they fight and just sparks fly off every time they get hit.
Or, you know, I like that too.
Could be. Yeah,
could be some type of electromagnetic shielding. Who knows?
Some type of shielding.
Something like that.
Yeah, or it could be a Megazord.
So Shrum fired two more arrows into this one. And I think one of them might have hit. Same thing happened. And then the other one, I think he missed. But
did he give him a Legolas? Like he shot the one, then quickly in quick succession, just bang, bang, two more? Yeah.
Oh, that's nuts.
If it helps with the imagery, yes, it's probably some type of Legolas.
I'm picturing like, I mean, the
he probably
first
had
one.
Them all three knocked at the same time and then let them go. One at a time.
So bad.
That's amazing. Let's go with that.
I feel like that would be the hardest weapon to use while shitting pants. You know, like while you're like terrified, like
a steady bow.
Yeah. You know, like fucking shit. Like especially when you have like zero training other than shooting defenseless animals.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that would be the worst weapon to have in this case, especially for someone 100%. Like me.
100%.
Agreed.
So those are all the arrows that Shrum was carrying at the time. So after he fires his three arrows, his ammunition is spent. He's got nothing left to shoot at these.
Surely, these though, he has other items that he could use to at his disposal.
It's good fucking Rambo knife.
This is true. Now, Shrum at the time believed that, you know, when he saw the robot creature clear off the embers of the fire, he marked in his head that this is probably, he kind of made a connection seeming to a theory that perhaps these creatures had some type of aversion, or at least like a curiosity to fire, or that they seem to want to avoid it. So Shrum in his possession had about 6 or 7 books of matches.
Wow.
And so he immediately thought to use the fire to scare these aliens away.
By lighting his tree on fire? Or how did he do it?
Well, not the tree, because he's sitting in the tree. So instead of the tree, though, you know, the first thing that Shrum throws out is one of the entire book of matches. He lights the whole thing on fire and he throws it down towards the creatures on the ground. And so this had the other two humanoids back away from the tree. And, you know, even farther back than they had been. So he goes full on pyro at this point. So once he sees that these creatures are avoiding and moving away, or seem to be have their aversion to fire, he starts. That's a sign of success for Shrum. And he starts lighting everything on fire. He takes off his hat. He said he takes off his hat and he said at the time, he's like, I guess I had a lot of hair oil on it, because when I lit that shit on fire, it
he was surprised. He was surprised when he lit it. He's like, oh shit.
Why are you going straight to clothes? Like, you got how many books of matches? Just keep fucking flicking matches at these guys.
Yeah, but that's wasting a whole
one book match
of matches. Like,
that makes
wasting
your clothes. Fox Andrew, message.
He was lighting the pack and then lighting the pack on fire and throwing it. If you throw one match out of the tree, it's out before it hits the ground.
All right.
Now, if you got really,
he's got good fuck. This is the '60s, man. They made
those
shit
aren't
to last.
Redbirds.
This is America.
Those aren't redbirds.
How do you know? These are seasoned hunters.
Because redbirds come in a box. That's how I know.
So, you know, Shrum's surprise is mirrored by the creatures on the ground, because they are also, you know, seem to be afraid, or, you know, want to avoid this large, the hat that, like, how far it kind of blazed and how brightly it burned as he threw that down. And they moved even further back. He said probably an estimate about 50 to 75 feet from the tree. And then at this point, he's like, I burned everything I had to burn. My hunting license, everything out of my wallet that would burn, all the dollar bills I had, I burned it.
So he would like light them on fire and then throw them out of the tree at the creatures?
Yep. Everything that was paper.
one little thing at a time?
Yeah. Taking everything out of his wallet, dollar bills. Boom,
fucking throwing loose change at them.
Throw it, yeah.
Get confused thinking he's at the fucking Rippers in Alberta throwing fucking loonies at him.
Hot quarters.
Yeah.
He's heating up the nickels.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he actually did throw his spare change at these creatures, like whatever was in his pockets. He had some spare change. He said, because he remembers that, and he specifically marked it, that he threw down coins at these things. But these things actually seem to be.
Oh, how badass would that be if he just fucking blasts them with his bow? Just boom, and then he'd keep the change, you filthy animals, and hucks a couple fucking dimes at them. Kick rocks, pal.
That's interesting, though, because, you know, these things, like Dan said, they scrambled to pick these things up and they're like examining him, right? Like they were interested in. He said it looked like they were interested in the pictures and like they were really giving them a good look.
And after the whole experience, there's still more to it. But after the whole event, like Shrum said that he had went down or came back and returned to the spot and he couldn't find any of the change that he had dropped. So
they took the change.
They took the change.
Hey, no, it's valuable.
Absolutely.
After he burned everything out of his wallet, all this paper material, and he ran out of stuff to kind of ran out of paper, he says that he began to tear off pieces of cloth. Like he started tearing off pieces of cloth from his jacket. And
yeah, that shit doesn't light easy, though.
Started lighting that stuff on fire and started throwing it everything burnable.
Wouldn't
at
you need
these
a fucking accelerant
creatures
on that kind of shit, though? Like, this is gonna light your shirt on fire.
Yeah, if it's like a heavy jacket, I don't think. No,
me and Braden, fucking 2011, we saw a guy try to light a jersey on fire. We sat there and it's just, that's not lighting, bud. It's not happening.
You need a lot of lighter fluid to get that going.
Yeah. This is the 60s, though. This is the 60s, though. Everything was flammable.
No, I guess. And listen, if these guys are seasoned hunters in the 60s, chances what they're wearing, 100% wool.
100% paper. Wearing paper clothes.
Wool.
Shit goes up real quick.
Wool, right? 100% wool. And it's not, all the information we have is that it wasn't raining or anything. So it's not wet wool. So if it's dry wool, that shit's going up fast, buddy. Like that's not taking it's time. Timber. It's not the synthetic stuff that we have now.
Well, maybe they're just wearing a Canadian tuxedo. It's all denim. That's not going to light very quick.
No. We got no clue.
Okay. So
that's what I wear hunting.
So he starts burning his clothes. What's right. left?
And anything, the only thing that he has left after he goes on his fire rampage is that he said that he was just pretty much his shirt, his pants, and his shoes. That's it. He's got like a cotton t-shirt. He's got his pants on and he's got his boots. And that's pretty much everything that he has on him. And he climbs up to the top of the tree since he's got no other type of, defense strategy other than to get up higher into the tree. He climbs up to the top, and this is when he ties himself to the trunk of the tree using his canteen belt.
Okay.
Canteen belt. I thought he had a harness.
Oh yeah, the canteen belt. That was the only thing.
It's like an extra long belt. It's not a harness. It's just a belt that you tie around your waist in a tree.
I know, but I thought he went camping with a fucking harness so he could post up in the tree.
Oh, that's what they do now.
It's just a belt. Right,
it's a canteen. It's just like a shoulder strap canteen.
So the canteen is the harness. Is that what we're establishing?
Well, he's just like wrapped that thing around the tree and just kind of like,
and then you wrap it around your high waist, then you can lean out.
Okay, I understand that he's using the canteen thing here, but I thought like I was under the understanding that he had a fucking like harness to potentially sleep up in this tree.
We might have said a harness, but I don't think we meant. He's got a long belt, so you can just like those linemen who climb poles. It's you throw the belt around and you kind of lean back and you can kind of hang.
Yes, yeah, that'd be everything harness. I read was it was a line belt, like a long belt, like an extra long belt for that purpose.
Okay,
so he's up the top of the tree. He's hanging on for dear life. He's expelled all items of flammable material other than a little bit of clothing he has left. And now what? Did any of his tactics scare the robot and other ETs away from the tree?
Well, while he is attached, once he finishes attaching, the task of attaching himself to the tree, he looks down and now there are two robots.
Oh, so it made it worse. Anything he did made it worse.
And at this point he stated like before he wasn't that sure, but now he's basically 100% they're there for him. Without a doubt.
So the original robot again approaches the tree, or what he identified as the original robot, and it began to again emit the gaseous vapor that it had before. So seeing the same type of tactic they had used before, and it has the same effect. It rises up through the tree branches, catches hold, and Shrum says that he blacked out again. And when he woke up and he looked down, what he saw was the two of the humanoid creatures had made it to the bottom of the tree and were trying to climb up the trunk in an effort to reach the first limb, which Shrum had used to climb the tree in the first place. So this first branch was about 12 feet off the ground, and Shrum had gotten to it by climbing on top of a rock that was near the tree, and then jumping from there to get to the branch, and then climbing, and then starting to climb the tree. But these creatures didn't seem interested in doing that, and they were pretty much just trying to, his description is, they were trying to boost each other up into the trunk to attain their grip on the first limb.
Now only if they had something that could fly. Hey, too bad.
But I imagine these two 5 foot something creatures are like standing on top of the other's shoulders.
They have a scout spaceship. What the fuck do they need to climb anything for?
Well,
knock the fucker out of the tree.
They like to do stuff the old fashioned way a little bit still. What do you can't take the whole ship to take down the
why not
object out of the tree.
Yeah.
Why not?
Why would you?
Because you want this guy bad enough, you're looking like assholes trying to climb this fucking thing and shooting vapor at him. Might as well just knock the fucking tree down. You got a spaceship.
It like it's like if you were in a helicopter, you wouldn't. You like if you're flying a helicopter, you wouldn't like. Other
yeah, than but it's not. It's a fucking. It's a thing that can fly through fucking time and space, man. You telling me they don't have the technology to get this dude out of the tree?
Time and space are much different than treetop retrieval,
I guess. Or yeah. You get robots fucking just knock the tree down.
They want them alive.
So every time these creatures try to get up into the tree, or they got close to reaching the branches, Shrum said that he initiated the strategy of shaking the tree or bending it, seeming to bend it as far as he could, getting the tree to kind of impart some movement into the tree. And he said every time that he did that, these creatures would kind of back off, and they would, anytime there was any type of movement like that went throughout the tree, they would kind of just back off and give up.
I had read that even at one point, one of them had kind of gotten in the tree and had almost grabbed like a foot, and he had like kicked this thing, kicked the hand, and it shimmied back down. Like that was one of the accounts I read.
So they're actively trying to grab him out of the tree by his feet.
Yeah, they're 100% coming for him.
At
this point, we've established
100%. Yeah, can we say it's 100%? They're trying to get him now.
Yeah, I think Shrum's at 100 too.
Okay,
perfect.
So, like now that they're trying to get up to physically climb the tree, Shrum has initiated the strategy of throwing everything. Like we said, he threw down the coins that he had in his thing. They didn't seem to be much of a deterrent. They seemed to garner the attention of the aliens for a second, kind of, you know, grab their attention. But then they just went back to trying to climb up the tree. Shrum said at one point he threw down his canteen, and the humanoids actually seemed interested in that as well, and picked that up and tossed it aside after a cursory evaluation of whatever it was. Shrum tried imitating calls of coyotes. He tried imitating wildlife calls, hoping that the visitors would think that he's trying to call for his companions or something, or signal a rescue.
Well sometimes
and drive them off.
What if this entire time they're just trying to help him? They're hooting at him, being like, "Hey, buddy, we're just trying to help you out of the tree. We're all good. We're friendly. Like, it's all good, man. We're just trying to help you out of the tree."
They have different rules.
That's why they haven't why they're not throwing shit at him or doing any cool technology. Maybe they thought, like, "Hey, we'll knock him out," because like that's what we do with bears. We sedate them and then they follow the tree. We catch them. Maybe that's what they're thinking.
Right,
maybe they want to get him out safely and just be like, "Hey, man, we're just trying to help you out, dude."
Now, Shrum trying to do the coyote calls is actually ingenious, because you know sometimes if you've ever been out in the woods at night, you do some howls. Sometimes you can get some coyotes to howl back or yipe back. So, like, if he did that, and perhaps some coyotes around started doing that, maybe these things would, in fact, think that there was, you know, he had some help out there. Unfortunately for him, they did not.
No.
Now, the two robots that are standing beneath the tree begin to perform some type of action, which Shrum started to recognize that they were facing each other. And then while standing at the base of the tree, he saw the entire base seem to be illuminated from light that was emanating from both the robots. And when he kind of looked closer through the branches to see what they were actually doing, he marked that there seemed to be flashes of light passing between the two robots from their chest, like their chest areas.
Did they do a dance and then merge?
Oh, Mechashiba.
No, they didn't defuse.
Mechashiba.
Yeah, I think he heard that. Yeah.
So kind of like they're doing some kind of like Care Bear thing, right?
Care Bear stare.
Energy under the chest.
Yeah, Care Bear stare.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what he said, that's like from this interaction that these two robots were doing, a large amount or a large volume of the gas or the vapor that he had seen before began to drift toward Shrum, like a larger amount than there had been before. And this rapidly expanding mist was so thick that Shrum couldn't even see the robots down below. Like, it was completely engulfing the bottom of the tree and completely obscuring these the humanoids and the robots from his sight. And then suddenly he feels a blast of intense cold and passes out.
So the same type of smoke as before, but now both the robots have joined forces and launching it
yeah.
double strength.
Shoot. Yeah, double strength, mega stream, whatever they hit
Megazord.
Him with.
Megazord.
They're like, we hit him 100. We hit him with 100 cc's of the smog, and he woke right back up. Like, double him up.
So after he passed out, he said that he remembers just before passing out, it was still dark. But when he finally awoke, still attached to the tree, you know, thankfully, it seemed to be that the first rays of the morning sun had appeared. And so this whole entire event seemed to be over, because when he looked down, the creatures, the robots, all of them were gone. He was just, you know, Shrum says, when I woke up, I was hanging just by my belt. My feet were hanging down and my head was hanging down. It was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet. And there was no sign of them, the aliens.
The aliens. So whatever, they smoked him out. He passed out again, but I guess he was high enough in the tree that they couldn't. Maybe they couldn't reach him, or maybe they did something to him up in the tree and this left him. It's not really clear, right? He wakes up in the aliens, they're gone.
He wakes up in the same place he passed out.
Right.
After this, Shrum managed to climb down from the tree, descend out of his perch, and then he headed in the direction of the camp where they had established the day earlier. And he said he walked about half a mile and that was it. Like, he was like, the fatigue started setting in, you know, the adrenaline started wearing off. And he just said he laid down on the ground and just fucking passed out, just fell straight to sleep.
Well, yeah, he was poisoned twice the night before. So
three times.
He got smoked three times?
I thought he got smoked three times.
Three times.
Oh, fuck.
Once, but one single smoke and then a double dose at the end, or twice singles and then a double
and
dose.
And double dose.
What a stressful fucking night of terror.
And then luckily for him, what he estimated is probably about, I don't know how he estimates these times, but he's looking at his watch, or I'm not sure, but he says about 5 minutes, and a short time later, he said that he was awakened by someone whistling nearby, and it was Vincent Alvarez, one of the hunting buddies they had been with and had been out looking for him. And Alvarez would write later, when he found Shrum, he would say the night had been very cold and all he had on him at the time I found him was a thin cotton t-shirt and his pants, and he was exhausted and tired.
So he ripped everything else off and burned it and threw it down.
So he wasn't, he wasn't wearing any of his camo stuff. Like, he didn't have any of his gear on that he had been, you know, that they had left camp with. All that was gone, and he was just wearing a cotton t-shirt and pants, which they had been not extremely cold, maybe not below freezing, but still cold enough that you'd be like, holy shit, like, what the fuck.
Yeah, dude,
it's California cold.
Anything under like 7 or 8 degrees Celsius, if you're not dressed like within a couple layers, is cold over extended time. So like, it could be real cold if you're only in a cotton shirt.
I don't care if it was 20 degrees overnight. If you left camp in fully dressed and came back in that, I'd be like, what happened to all your clothes?
What the fuck, man?
What happened to you?
Man, you're not supposed to eat the berries, man.
Yeah.
I don't care how hungry you got. Don't eat that shit. Stop smoking the, what's it? Mazenza bush. What the fuck?
Manzanita.
Manzanitas.
That is got to be one of the most terrifying one-on-one ET encounters we've discussed. Like, it's just him versus the aliens all night long.
Yeah, he took shots at him. Like, just everything is just... This is a wild encounter. Like, it's a fantastic encounter of otherworldly creatures and a fantastic account of a person encountering beings from, you know, seemingly another world.
No doubt.
Now, these events would weigh heavily on Shrum even later into his life. Like, immediately following, like weeks, not even weeks, days after returning home from this event, his wife, Judy, would talk about how that he had nightmares. Like, he would wake up in the middle of the night screaming. Mostly about the eyes. Like, he would be, you know, something like the eyes, they're watching me. And so, you know, he displayed a lot of symptoms that people would associate with PTSD from this event.
No, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Judy would actually write because of the concern that she had for her husband. And, you know, when he told her, like, he sat her down and told her about this, like, just shortly after he had returned from the trip, and told her all of the details of what had happened. And in 1973, she would write to NICAP, which is the precursor to MUFON. If anybody's familiar with that.
Such a cooler name. They should have kept it.
Nikon?
NICAP. It sounds NICAP. Way more NICAP. Bass than MUFON.
And so, you know, she would write about how long this had affected Donald, like, mentally, psychologically, since that had happened, you know, even like a decade, you know, close to a decade after these events, he had just endured some kind of, you know, an extraterrestrial attack or assault or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, he would wake up screaming for years about what happened that night.
A traumatic event just followed him forever.
His wife had to take it into her own hands to, like, be like, okay, well, we need some answers. We need something. He needs some sort of help because this is crazy. We can't keep going on like this.
And so, Donald originally did not want the story to go public. Like, they're living in the very kind of peak of UFO kind of things. You had Betty and Barney Hill happening. You had other UFO flaps. You had all the kind of UFO madness, you know, that was going on around that times. But Donald didn't want this story coming out.
Well, didn't he? He was like, he built fucking missiles for a living too, didn't he?
Right. He did work
yeah, you don't want people to think you're a fucking nutter.
That worked with the government, that had government contracts. And so that was one of the reasons the biggest reason that he didn't want any of this stuff getting out, for him to be kind of labeled as a security risk, or, you know, at worst, you know, lose his job. It was a good job. And so that was one of the biggest reason that he didn't want this stuff to come out. You know, he didn't want to make waves about this kind of thing. Although this stuff is happening. And then after, you know, after a certain point, he started getting in contact with people kind of being like, to kind of talk about what had happened. He was actually put in contact with the U.S. Air Force. A couple of U.S. Air Force officers were arranged by an astronomer, Victor Killick, that was associated with, that had, you know, gained the acquaintance of Donald Shroom after kind of his story kind of started kind of a little circulating a little bit. And he had gone to talk to these, you know, he thought it would be in his best interest to talk to these Air Force officers about what had happened. So Shrum recalls going to Shrum and Judy, his wife, recall going to this meeting with these two Air Force officers, and them eventually trying to explain away his encounter. They kind of threw a couple theories at him, being like, oh, you know what? Maybe it was this. Maybe it was some, you know, military exercises going on in that area. Maybe it was, I think, one of the more.
They're like, maybe military exercises. And he has some, he's like, well, I don't think so. Didn't feel like that. They're like, well, you know, probably a couple Boy Scouts out there playing pranks.
Boy Scouts playing pranks, dressed up in robot costumes.
Yeah. So he's like, you know, he's like, well, like a Boy Scouts out in the middle of the woods? Like, I don't think so. And they're like, oh, okay, all right, you got us. It's a rogue team of Japanese fighters who landed here during World War II, don't know the war's over. That's who it's got to be. That's what it was.
Fucking Red Dawn Part 2 here.
Yeah, and he's like, what? they didn't shoot me for real? I don't think so. All right, we've given you all the answers.
Shrum and Judy, they both kind of, when they recall the events, they thought their sentiments were that they felt that the Air Force officer were being kind of dismissive of Shrum's claims about what had happened. But Shrum cooperated fully with them. And, you know, he even brought one of the arrows that he fired at the robots during the encounter. And this was the one smart. That he remarked on being the best example of the one. This is the first one that he had shot at the robot the first one. And then he remembers it having kind of some unique properties or markings on it that was like, the arrowhead seemed to be kind of melted on it. And it appeared to have like a, what he said is like a very muted rainbow like coloration, like probably, something that's signifying that some type of chemical reaction or something had happened to change the chemical composition, perhaps, of the arrowhead itself. And they asked, you know, the Air Force officers, like, can we send this? So can we borrow this and send it away for metallurgical analysis? And so Strom was like, yes, of course. Like, yeah, take it. I want to know what happened. Of course, you know, Strom still wants to know what had happened. You know, this is just a year after it's like almost a year to the day. What happened? This is September 25th, 1964, that they had this meeting. And in September of 1968, you had James H. Aikman, who was the United States Air Force's Community Relations Division in Washington, write a letter in which he stated that a formal investigation was conducted by McClellan Air Force Base on September 25th, 1964. Mr. Strom provided the Air Force with an arrow tip, but not with a complete arrow. The tip was not subjected to any laboratory analysis. It has been loaned to the University of Colorado UFO Study Group and has yet to been returned to Mr. Strom. And then that's pretty much all you ever hear of that arrow.
It was never subjected to any laboratory analysis, so they didn't do anything.
The Air Force didn't. They sent it to, they loaned it to the University of Colorado, and then just, you never really hear anything after there. That.
Oh.
Of that arrow. So, but he still had the other two arrows. Right. So he still had the other two arrows. And in addition to loaning the one to the Air Force, Strom gave Strom gave them also a annotated map, like the exact location of where this stuff had happened. So two or three weeks later, Strom said that he went back with his brother, Bill, and his friends, Vincent Alvarez and Bill McAdams, who had been with him on the trip. And they returned to the exact scene where Strom had said that he had had this encounter. And then when they got there, Strom says that they discovered that it seemed to be that the ground had been combed over the entire area. That he even said that he was able to pick out like rake marks, that this entire area had just been completely, you know, wiped over and seemed to be, you know, all traces of what had happened were gone.
Well, he's in touch with these two Air Force guys. They go up the ladder. Maybe, you know, so this is a pretty singular account, but maybe they tracked this craft on radar or something. Maybe someone else, maybe they knew about it. And there's like, let's go get rid of any evidence. This guy said that he threw like 45 pieces of clothing out of a tree. Let's go rake those up. Let's go get rid of everything and just make it look like nothing ever happened and just bury it. Mm-hmm.
And so with that, then that was Strom's conclusion as well, is that it seemed to be that people had closed this, because he also remarked that they had found cigarette butts and some discarded cigarette packages.
Tons of cigarette butts, various brands, packages.
And so Strom's conclusion was that the Air Force had kind of put together a task force hastily to try and cover, with a specific purpose to cover up any remaining evidence of Strom's encounter.
Why wouldn't they though? Why wouldn't they? Like, if he comes and tells us he has this account, you think they would, like, it didn't strike me as that ridiculous that at this time that they wouldn't send someone. They gave him a map. Why wouldn't they follow it up? Why wouldn't they comb the trees where they think, yeah, to see if there's any, like, anything that comes up? So, like, all while hacking darts, it's the 60s, right? Or 70s. This didn't surprise me that much. I don't know if they were hastily trying to cover anything up or if they were
looking seeing for if there's any evidence they could recover. Alien shit. That makes more sense. Because what are they going to say? Some random dude lighting shit on fire? Like, go ahead, tell your story, dude. It's irrelevant. We don't care.
Yeah.
We want cool alien technology.
Yeah.
So Strom managed to actually, while they were out there as well, he found the other arrow. So like I said before, he had two arrows, but this is when he recovered like the
He found the second one when all the fucking G-men ripping the place apart didn't find anything.
It was in a bush.
Yes. It was in a bush. That might
not have been found. It was in a fucking Mazenza bush.
No, think about it though.
We found it. That's what he said.
Think about it. Those guys who were sent out there from the Air Force, they're all hacking darts left and right. They're like, oh, fuck, what are we doing out here? This is, okay.
They literally ripped the fucking ground up looking for shit.
No, they're raking the ground.
Yeah.
On the tree, by the tree.
By the tree.
But if he missed with that arrow and it went a couple hundred yards into a random bush, right?
Yeah.
Only he would know the direction. That doesn't, honestly, that is the least.
Yeah, he would only know the direction and the fucking arrow he shot while shitting his pants at a giant robot in the pitch black.
The general direction.
In the fucking pitch black because he couldn't see anything but fucking two large
Strom
eyes.
Strom has the two arrows from the Cisco Grove encounter. And so he manages to loan both of these to the NICAP investigator who was kind of assigned to his case, Paul Cerny. And Paul Cerny takes those to for a metallurgical analysis so they could be done. Now, the arrowheads were sent to the laboratory of Pennsylvania or a laboratory in Pennsylvania that was NICAP was familiar with using. But Cerny would later explain that the Shrum's arrowhead were packed in cotton prior to being tested. And this is important because by the time they were removed from the packing, the strange traces of metal that had apparently because of the way that the cotton packing had kind of surrounded the arrowheads, that strange metal had flaked off and fallen onto the cotton. So the lab accidentally threw away the cotton along with the metal flakes. So they didn't find anything mm-hmm. on the arrows themselves.
That's a tragic end to the tale. So they got rid of the only arrowhead left that could have shown if the arrowhead hit the robot, sparked, left some residue. Whatever residue was on there is lost in the cotton wrapping from the packaging.
So. Yeah. But like I said, Donald Shrum kind of sat on this story until 2007. Now, there are previous iterations of the story that were published in one or two publications like UFO magazines that didn't necessarily mention his name. And some of them actually had like a bit of embellishment and some of them were kind of,
already. That's fucking crazy.
Well, they kind of said that they were either embellished or that they were, some of the stories had inaccuracies that were printed alongside and people kind of, probably taken liberties with some of the story. So Shrum didn't actually put his story, his entire telling of the story, down on paper until 2007. And then, actually put his name onto it. And then they went in and Noe and Uriarte put together the book and then, managed to interview him. So this is like, which is, it's such a shame. Like, it's actually a shame because it's like, this is a really great story. Like, it's a really great UFO encounter account. And it's just like the fact that it kind of stood, it's kind of stays hidden and it's not lumped in with, Betty and Barney Hill, Travis Walton, any of those things. I find it's fucking travesty, man.
Yeah, no, it's a wild story. Fun story.
A lot of fun. A
lot of fun to this. Just put yourself in his shoes and you're up the tree and there's fucking, two humanoids, two robots, they're gassing you, they're trying to grab you out of the tree, you're shooting arrows at them.
It's fucking wild.
Wild. Why make it up? Why? 40 years later, he finally tells the story?
No, but he had told the story before. Well, like, the story had been printed. Like,
he just remained anonymous.
Yeah, the most of the time, like, the story would end up being the times it had been published, or at least, retellings of the story as Shrum, as people had heard it, had been printed, but it left his name out of it and just would be kind of lumped in with other UFO encounters. But this one never put his name to it until 2007.
See, I like that about this story is that he was anonymous all that time. So whatever like fame from doing a UFO circuit, doing all the radio shows and stuff, he didn't cash in on that his whole life. Right. He finally came out when he's probably an old, like really old man at this time, 2007.
It's time to let everybody know how much of a fucking badass I am.
Like the book that he was interviewed to do, like that didn't get, again, that didn't get published until 2011. So like, why even make it up?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Why make it up at this point?
Yeah. It's, it doesn't really add up that this is like, you know, we never shook his hand at any alien cons. Like, you know, you don't hear his name going in convention circuits. Like, this is not someone who, you know, monetized this. He didn't benefit from it. If anything, this tale tells you that he suffered greatly.
Yeah, I had to dig for this one. Like, I had to dig for this encounter. It's not something that pops up like right off the bat. Like, you have to go in and actually look for it and kind of know what you're looking for. And this one was hard to find. And I was like, why?
It's not like a main staple in ufology. Like, it's not something people point to, or it doesn't come up a lot. There's not a ton of content on it on the internet.
Yeah.
Podcasts, YouTube, anything. Not a lot, not a ton, but fun one.
Can we get into final thoughts?
Let's do it.
Final thoughts.
All right. So, like, for looking into this one, you know, kind of online, you can easily find a bunch of people saying this guy's bullshitting. They point to some inaccuracies of, like, why didn't the robots just climb the tree? It's ridiculous, right? He was just in a tree. They can traverse space and time, but they can't, you know, they're foiled by a man who climbs tree. This is stupid and all this stuff. You know, I looked at that and I really thought, I went, you know what, well, why make this up? Like, why make that story up? So then I really kind of leaned into that. Like, I do believe this guy. I do believe this account. I just think we have to look at the reason maybe why these extraterrestrials or robots or whatever they may be, what they were doing there and what their purpose was in doing that. Because maybe they didn't want to abduct this person. Maybe they had ulterior motives, and I didn't really come up with something, but after hearing, you know, the Manzanita talk, it does seem like they were there for that bush originally, and stumbling upon, Donnie up in the tree was just kind of happen chance. So
happen chance.
So, like, I believe him. I think this is a really, well-told account of this person's terrible experience. And I happen to believe it. I believe that after he told the Air Force and pointed it, I believe they sent people out. Man, this isn't that far off of Roswell days. You know what I mean? So, like, I can't see that they wouldn't send a task force to go comb an area. To me, that's totally believable. They were just going looking. I don't think they were particularly going to hide stuff like kind of Donald makes it seem. I think they were looking for stuff. And, you know, if it's a couple year after, they're taking rakes to the ground to kind of stir up the ground because shit falls, it grows, right? So they're just searching for any kind of leftovers. Dan, I'll toss it over to you.
My final thoughts is Andrew kind of touched on it originally before. My idea was that perhaps like these extraterrestrials had been down there. Perhaps their primary objective was to kind of search unusual things. I remember it always sticks in my head. There is the director's cut. I don't think it's in the original cut, but I think it's in like the director's cut of ET. And it kind of Steven Spielberg kind of expanding on the idea or the concept that, you know, aliens come here for like very stuff for us that would be mundane. Like they come in, they're getting like pine cones, and like pine cones are worth more than diamonds to them. Cause essentially like you could find diamonds anywhere, their entire planet's made out of diamonds and these kinds of things, but biological things, life things like that, those are, might be more rare. So stuff like the comment that they make about the Manzanita bush seems to be lend a little bit more significance to that kind of interaction that they had with their environment. So perhaps they were looking for these Manzanita, like especially like a plant that's like you can't find anywhere on Earth. So it's like that would be like it's even more rare that to find, you know, a planet with life, maybe, like, and then find this plant or this, you know, this biologic organism that exists only in one place on the entire planet. Mm. Like maybe that's what they were there for. And then like to address like why their interest in Donnie Shrum is to be like, maybe they just saw him stuck in the tree and they were kind of like funny firemen with a cat.
Yeah.
They're like, you're stuck in a tree, bud. Like we're trying to help you down. Like, you know, and then it's just a really angry cat. Like getting
it's just
really
throw that shit down.
You
know?
And you're like, we're just trying to help you. Like,
right. That makes,
come on, man.
The robot at the first thought that maybe he got scared up there by the fire. So he puts out the fire.
Yep. He's like, come on down. Come on. And then he's just like, ting, and you're like, oh man, come on.
Yeah.
Just acts of aggression in the tree.
And he's making coyote noises. Like,
yeah, they're like, he's really unhappy.
We should get him down. He's going to hurt himself. Like, we should get him down from there. So that's what I think. I think maybe they're trying to be good interstellar Samaritans, and they were trying to help him down from the tree.
I like that a lot.
On the whole thing.
Andrew, what do you think?
I mean, this one was a lot of fun. I think it was a really cool story.
And true.
As far as not climbing the tree, like Braden was saying, when people try to disprove it. Like, first of all, maybe they've never seen a tree before. Maybe this is their first time on the planet. They don't know what a fucking tree is. Or maybe on their planet, they don't climb things. They've never had to. They don't know how to.
They don't have the muscles.
Right? That's just something they don't know.
They're so squat because gravity is so strong on their
It's just not even planet, a possibility
so they
for
just
them.
Don't climb stuff.
Yeah. Right? Right? Or maybe they just see it's putting themselves into too much danger potentially. I don't know. But for me, I just, like, it's tough because with all this technology to get to Earth, and it seems like they really fucking wanted this guy. I mean, fucking old Shermie here, Shrim, you know, he was 100% positive they wanted him. And I think if these fucking people, I think if they really wanted him.
Well, maybe 99.99.
Well, if they, even with 99.9999, if they really wanted him, I feel like they would have got him, right? I don't think they would have given up after the fucking fourth gas, right? I truly think that they would have got him. I think it's a really cool story. I think he thought he saw something, you know, was he eating bushes, fucking berries off the bushes? Potentially. I don't know. Was he dreaming? I don't know. You know, did he wake up? Was there a little bit of, you know, a little bit of fucking paradoxical hypothermia? And that's why he stripped his clothes. And when he woke up and he passed out, that's why he was only wearing a t-shirt and jeans. Potentially. I don't know. But it was a fun fucking story.
Hell yeah. Yeah. I would agree. I like the theory that, so these ETs are coming here for this manzanita tree. This is one of the most rare plants on Earth. Maybe what we think of like as fuel for interdimensional travel is not red mercury or some type of uranium. It's some manzanita sap that we don't even recognize as being a like highly valuable commodity. But maybe this plant only grows on a handful of planets in our galaxy. And, you know, that's why there's so many sightings in California, not just in this one in general, but just in California. So they're here. They are.
I like that.
They're excavating these plants, or they're looking for these plants. They just by chance come across our boy here, Shrum. And the rest, I'm not sure if they're fucking with him or what they're doing. But yeah, they can't climb. Because we always depict like little ETs, like especially as grays, as like they have no muscle. They're not going to be able to pull themselves up a tree. If you just look at their body type, you're like, there's no way this guy can do a pull up. It's impossible. So maybe they just can't get up the tree. They're not really there for him. So they just kind of like, they fuck with him a bit. Like Dan said, like the cat up the tree. They fuck with him a bit. They try and gas him out. It doesn't work. They just leave him. They grab their manzanita sap and off they go.
Cut their losses
and mm-hmm. off they go.
Yep.
And in doing this though,
they're like, fine, fuck you then.
Fuck you. And in doing this though, they leave this guy with a lifelong traumatic experience. He suffers PTSD. That's what I think. I think he didn't profit. He didn't go right to he wasn't on all the shows doing the network. He didn't like
Into the UFO tour, like
didn't do a tour.
Guy falls asleep in the fucking tree, sees a couple owls, freaks out, starts shooting arrows at him, fucking doesn't know what's happening, starts lighting shit on fire.
Hey.
And then this turns into his fucking Al Bundy fucking Polk High story where he goes around telling everybody how much of a badass he is shooting arrows at fucking robots.
Yeah.
Then his family, he's been telling this story through his family for years, right? He's been telling them like, yeah, this fucking happened. It's fucking crazy. Then one of his grandkids were like, you gotta write a book, man. Come on, Papa, write a book. It's crazy. So he does.
And it's hard to corroborate his events specifically because he's the only one. But the other guy did see the lights that night, the UFO.
Yeah.
Interesting.
He corroborates that.
So at least there was something seen by more than one person from more than one location. I mean, it's his word versus what you think for his story.
Well, if we could see the lights, can't we go back and look at the fucking star map and see if there's fucking special lights at that point in time or anything like that?
You're saying it's a atmospheric phenomenon.
Maybe. I don't know.
But it was a fun story. Fun to look into if you haven't. There's a couple interviews out there. There's not a lot of good stuff, but there is a little bit if you want to
hashtag look 100% or 99.99% recommend the book. The book's really good. Got a huge appendices, like got a bunch of interviews with Donald Trump himself and a lot of stuff in there. It's real fun. It's real good read. It's real fun. They're not paying me to say that.
They are not. Fun case though. We got to start wrapping this one up. We didn't discuss beforehand, so maybe we'll have to skip it this week. A theorite of the week. We completely forgot. No,
we could give it to the ATI for those fucking sweet cards they sent all of us with cool stickers.
We could give it to the ATI in general.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so as a group.
No, what's funny is the ATI sent cards. Dan, I have your card here. I had Andrew's card here. I didn't get a card.
What?
It got lost in the mail, probably.
Oh, yeah, probably.
That's hilarious.
But custom-made ATI cards. The ATI...
with stickers, they're cool.
I think I finally put a firewall on the ATI. Hopefully, I just can keep them out of my computer here for a bit.
Well, maybe that's all we have to do is make them theorites of the week, and then they'll leave us alone.
Maybe that's it.
Maybe that's what it is.
Maybe that'll do it. Theorites of the week are whoever the ATI may be. Let's give it to them.
The other thing I just wanted,
whatever
or whatever.
The other thing I wanted to announce is happened chance of me being gone, and then Zell having his offspring. We didn't get a chance to announce the meat draw winner, and that meat draw winner is Anna LeBlanc. I'll be in contact with you shortly.
Is that for the pumpkin
prize? Sorry, I didn't get an opportunity to do the big wheel of spins.
Spinning
for everyone, but this last month's winner is Anna LeBlanc.
So, and that was for the pumpkin carving contest.
Yeah, she did some awesome. She did 3 turnips. They looked amazing.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, do we have the pictures? Can we put them on socials sometime?
Yeah. They're on our stories right now.
Perfect. Go check them out. Alien Theorist podcast on pretty much everything, or at Truth Is Out There on Twitter. All right. End of the show. Everyone's favorite time. If you're not supporting the show and you want access to the live stream, ad-free show, early access, all the other goodies, patreon.com/alientheoristpodcast, or find the link in the podcast description. This week's newest supporters: Tail, Jimmy W, Willie B, Megan Schmidt, Brennan, oh, this is a great name, Swamp Squatch.
Yeah.
Full Year Pledge by Natalie Steins, Austin. Woo. Vincent, and last but not least, Kyle Weir. Thank you very much for supporting the show.
And as we always say at the end of these things, keep those eyes on the skies.
Peace, everybody.
I was thrown off this whole case file by looking at Dan with no glasses.
I know, right?
Yeah.
It's weird. And
you realize like the huge expanse that is between my eyes, like the huge, like
it's got a huge bridge.
So, it's really weird.
Isn't it? Is it growing as we're?
Weirds me out.
I was like, wow. Your brain is so big, it's got to make room for it. Just splits your eyes apart.
Yeah, your brain is splitting your skull in two and your eyes are separate.
Yeah, because it's happening.
Something. Your eyes wide or am I narrow? Who knows anymore?
I got contacts.